A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
The moment you say, I love you, you get your benefits. The moment you say, te quiero mucho, you don't get your benefits. So that's the weird part, and that's the part that needs to change.
Actor Pablo Azar is a star in the world of Spanish language soap operas. He's been in 10 of them. His telenovela characters live in a world of luxury, but Azar says working non-union jobs on Telemundo has left him without benefits, residuals, or even the same pay he would get on an English language production. That's why he, like many other telenovela actors, has had to work outside jobs. This very recognizable star tells us about the reactions he's gotten from fans while driving for Uber. Then, before Jonas Cuarón worked with his father Alfonso on the award-winning Gravity, he wrote a script for a thriller set on the U.S.-Mexico border. Now he's brought that story to life with Desierto, Mexico's submission for the Best Foreign Language Oscar. Cuarón tells us how he set out to make a genre movie that turned out to be unexpectedly political. But first on the News Banter, a revolt brews at Sony, and Ryan Reynolds will make the sequel to Deadpool without the director of the original. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Sony. You know, Sony, a couple years ago, we were talking about the Sony hack. Amy Pascal, the head of the film studio, was dismissed after that. She said by her own account that she was fired. She was replaced by Tom Rothman. Now, Amy Pascal was known as a filmmaker-loving, free-spending person to a fault. You know, the consensus in the industry was that Sony movies, even when they worked, cost too much. That when they didn't work, they were, you know, debacles. James L. Brooks had a 2010 movie, How Do You Know, which was a spectacular bomb and cost just crazy amounts of money, over $100 million. And she was replaced, as I say, by Tom Rothman. And he is the diametric opposite. He had been at Fox. He was known for just being so hands-on and obsessed with driving down budgets. So Sony went from one extreme to the other. And it turns out that at the studio, a lot of high-level executives are deeply unhappy, tried to pull off a coup and unseat Tom Rothman by complaining to Human Resources and complaining to Michael Linton, who was Tom Rothman's boss.
Right. I mean, this is an interesting window into the culture and the mood at Sony right now, because there have not been a lot of hits there. They have not had the franchise films that have driven a lot of the other studios. Their big play this summer was Ghostbusters, which did not perform as expected. And now it's far enough into the tenure of Tom Rothman where these movies that he has spearheaded are starting to come out. Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is the Ang Lee movie, that's supposed to be their big award season play, and at least the initial reactions to that movie have not put it in the awards race. They have a big sci-fi romance with Jennifer Lawrence called Passengers that's coming out over the holidays. That's a big bet from Tom Rothman. And if these movies don't work, it's no longer Amy Pascal's show. It's Tom Rothman's show. And it seems like they are kind of on edge.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Rothman had been there before running one of the labels. He revived the TriStar label, and he had movies under that label, notably Ricky and the Flash with Meryl Streep and The Walk, which was a Bob Zemeckis movie that did not perform at all. And so his detractors, and he has many, he's a difficult personality, say, you know, he's supposed to be so smart. Why did these movies perform so poorly? And as you say, these next movies, it looks like Billy Lynn may well underperform. And Passengers, who knows? That's a high-stakes proposition for him. But, you know, the way I see this, it's really extraordinary for a group of high-level executives. I mean, we're not disclosing names, but there is a group of them to go to Human Resources, to go to Michael Linton, and try to unseat a studio chairman. He's a couple of years into his tenure, and that kind of revolt, I don't think I remember anything like it in the time I've been covering this beat.
Yeah, it is interesting. But then you could make the other argument that, you know, if you bring in someone like Tom Rothman the culture of Sony is going to change and people aren't going to be happy about it. And that's kind of the point. If the problem was Amy Pascal and all of the budget-busting movies and people doing whatever they want, and you bring in someone who is a taskmaster, who's known as being frugal, is known as being someone who can whip the studio into shape, people are going to be upset.
I think that's how it's being read in Tokyo at Sony headquarters, which is to the dismay of those people who, and a lot of whom I have to say, they're very responsible professional people, and they obviously are feeling that they're in an extraordinary circumstance. I mean, the irony here is that they've gone from one extreme to the diametric opposite extreme. And somewhere in the middle, I'm going to assume that Tom Rothman has been told because of this, you know, you need to find a way to not make people, you know, feel so unhappy with your interference, your perceived interference in decisions that are being made. You know, he's known to be so hands-on in marketing and all across the board. I'm going to assume that he's been talked to. And what's going to be interesting is if things don't change at a certain point, this group of executives has probably threatened, I'm assuming, that they will consider leaving and whether they start to go.
Yeah, although, you know, you noted earlier this week in a nice little item that Tom Rothman and Michael Lynton, the CEO of Sony, were seen very publicly having lunch at the Sony commissary on Monday morning. And that is definitely signaling to everyone that, hey, you know, I've got his back. He and I talked and we're fine, at least for now.
That's for now, the public, right. Public,
yeah, that's the public positioning.
Yeah, we'll see what the private position may has any effect. So pivoting to a problem that Fox had, it had a big hit with Deadpool, a welcome hit. And this was a movie that was sort of created outside of the Fox incubator by Tim Miller, who was a special effects guy who has been a guest on our show. He really was credited, although he has denied it, with leaking test footage from the movie Deadpool to induce Fox to say yes, to greenlight this movie, which worked. They went viral online and fans got into it. But as time went on, Ryan Reynolds, who is the star of Deadpool, started to diverge in his vision with this guy, Tim Miller, who a lot of fans think was so key to the success and tone of Deadpool. They got into a creative dispute. And Ryan Reynolds, who really was brought back from the dead by Deadpool because his career had been really compromised, you know, he put down his foot and it was either it's him or me. And the studio was confronted with a really unappetizing choice. Either the guy who is the face of the movie, the guy who you see on screen, or the guy behind the camera. And obviously they felt that they had no choice. I mean, my sources are telling me this is a very reluctant decision on Fox's part, but they could not make peace. These guys had been arguing for a while. So Tim Miller went off. He's going to do another project at Sony for Tom Rothman, who used to be at Fox. And Ryan Reynolds is now sort of, in effect, in charge of Deadpool. But, you know, the cause of making fans not worry about this too much was not helped when the guy who did the music for the first film then announced on Facebook that he's leaving, and he's leaving in defense of Tim Miller.
Yeah, I mean, this would be the equivalent of if Christian Bale drew a line in the sand and said, I'm coming back as Batman, but only if Chris Nolan isn't going to be the director. I mean, that's how big a hit this was for Fox. I mean, it created a franchise out of a character that was an afterthought in the X-Men universe. It launched this whole R-rated superhero movie genre that I think other studios are now trying to follow. And the question is, can Fox salvage this project with another director and, you know, keep it going just to keep their star happy?
Yeah, I mean, the composer Tom Holkenborg went on Facebook and said that Tim Miller, he called him the brilliant creative director of the film, the driving force behind Deadpool, who got him involved in the project. He said, Deadpool without Tim at the helm does not sit right with me. That's why I've decided not to be involved. That creates a perception problem. I mean, not necessarily that everyone is sitting there fixated on the music, although music is, I'm not downplaying the importance of music at all. But the perception is probably the bigger problem, because you know, there's a sense that now this is no longer true Deadpool and the fans could turn.
They could, or they could not care in a year and a half when this movie comes out and it's good and what they want. I mean, who knows? Ryan Reynolds was very involved in Deadpool and crafting the story and the character and everything else. And from what we understand is he's going to be very, very involved in the sequel. So I wouldn't declare this franchise dead yet.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. at one point in the 2014 Telemundo soap opera Reino de Corazones, actor Pablo Azar's character believes he's been betrayed. Wearing a tux and waving a gun, he threatens a woman in a revealing ball gown as she shrinks in the corner of a lavishly decorated bedroom.
El asesino siempre es el más bueno, ¿no? El más inocente. Ese. Ese del que nadie sospecha.
Azar is well known for his work in telenovelas, which are popular with Spanish-speaking audiences around the world. But for Azar, the on-screen glamour does not reflect his reality. Actors in Telemundo productions are not protected by SAG-AFTRA, which means they don't get the same pay as they would for English language programs, and they don't get benefits, including health insurance, pensions, or residuals. For Azar, that meant driving an Uber to supplement his income. SAG-AFTRA has been working to unionize Telemundo productions, a battle that heated up earlier this year when Telemundo announced it was building a new $250 million production facility in Miami. The difference between union and non-union work came into sharp focus for Azar when he recently appeared on the TBS show Wrecked, a comedy about a group of people stranded on an island after a plane crash.
What?
Wait a minute, so that wasn't the last bag of pretzels we were fighting over?
Azar didn't have a big role, but as a member of SAG-AFTRA, he was covered. We got Azar on the line in Miami while he was on a break from shooting the new Telemundo telenovela La Fan.
I've been working in Miami as a Latino actor for productions in Spanish for 10 years. And one of the things that was very intriguing to me is that actors in Latin America, in countries like Mexico, countries like Colombia, like Argentina, they do have protection in the sense of they belong to a union, so they do get benefits like health insurance, like royalties, residuals, etc., etc. And since we're working legally as actors here in the United States, I am an American citizen. So people need to know that Latino actors here in Miami are not living the lives that they think we do. Because, you know, we do go to the red carpets. We do get to the limousines. So people do think that we live like Brad Pitt or like, you know, all those Hollywood actors, that they do have great lives because they are covered, because they get paid what they deserve. We don't.
And how much are you working as an actor? I mean, you've been in a lot of productions. I'm sorry, I don't speak Spanish, so I haven't been able to see the telenovelas, but there seem to be a lot.
Yeah, well, I have been in 10 different telenovelas for Telemundo only. Besides Telemundo, I've worked for other companies like Venevisión, Televisa, Fox Latin America, and I also recently did my first TV show in English. So I know how is it to work with SAG-AFTRA as the union and to work in a non-union project here in the United States.
And you don't see a significant difference in terms of what you're doing work-wise, but there's a big difference in what I assume you're paid and the lack of benefits.
Yeah, work-wise, there is no difference. I mean, we're doing the same job. The thing is, the moment you say, I love you, you get your benefits. The moment you say, te quiero mucho, you don't get your benefits. So that's the weird part, and that's the part that needs to change.
Now, with all of the work you've been doing, you still drive an Uber when you're not acting.
Yeah, it's not like I do the Uber thing regularly. I went through a tough situation after I did a show for Telemundo in 2014. I did what every actor does, which is go to another audition, try to get a new job. And on that time that you're not working, that you don't have a contract, we don't get any other payments or residuals or anything. So we need to find ourselves new ways to make a living. In my case, at that time, I found that on the Uber thing. But it's not only the Uber thing. A lot of actors are waiters. Another actors sell real estate, but almost 80% of the actors that live in the United States and work regularly in projects in Spanish must have another side job to be able to make a living.
I mean, of course, it's a cliche, and, you know, especially in Hollywood, the actor who was a waiter, but you're talking about people who, I guess, have enough success that if they were in the union, they would be making a living without waiting tables.
Yeah, that's the main thing. We're not talking about here actors that are trying to make it, trying to get a career. I would never see Winona Ryder driving an Uber. I would never see Brad Pitt being a waiter. They did that when they were trying to make it. The problem with Hispanic actors is not that we are trying to make it. We already made it. I'm already a worldwide known Hispanic star. My novellas are sold to more than 80 countries in the whole world. So an actor that has that kind of career in the English market, they are perfectly able to make a living out of their acting.
So given that you've done that much work, how many times did people step into an Uber that you were driving and say, is that you?
Well, especially at the beginning, I tried to disguise myself, put a hat, sunglasses, so people won't ask me. But I do get, well, I'm not doing the Uber right now because I'm doing another show for Telemundo. But when I was doing the Uber, yeah, I did had a lot of people asking me if I was the actor. They would never believe that I was the actor because they were like, oh, you look like the actor from Telemundo. And I would be like, oh, yes, I get that all the time. But sometimes I got to confess, I was ashamed to say that I was the actor because then they would start asking questions. So then why are you working for Uber? Aren't you supposed to be rich or something? So most of the time I would just deny that I was the actor from Telemundo.
Do you worry at all that by being so outspoken? I know Telemundo has apparently said that if SAG-AFTRA wants to organize among the Hispanic actors, they should go ahead. But often employers, you know, they're legally obligated to say that. It's illegal to say that they can't unionize,
yes,
that workers can't unionize. I don't know if you feel it's sincere, if you worry that they might retaliate to, or you try to punish you for being outspoken on this subject.
Well, I'm only telling the truth. I'm not attacking anyone. I'm just telling my own experience of what I had to do as an actor, and that's a reality. So, yeah, they did say that if actors want to organize with SAG-AFTRA that they are free to do it, but it's not as easy as it sounds. First of all, because Florida, it's a right-to-work state, which means that it doesn't require any unions to organize employees. Second, there still has to be some negotiation from Telemundo with SAG-AFTRA, which I cannot tell you because I don't know why it hasn't happened. The reality is that there are no negotiations for now, as far as I know.
So was the thing that made you decide to speak out about this, was it the experience of working on a TBS show, on a SAG-AFTRA show, or was this something you were already concerned with?
Well, it was way before, because I'm a member of the Mexican Union of Actors. I'm a member of the Spanish Union of Actors. Spain pays me royalties for some of the novellas that they show that were filmed in Telemundo, but it's not Telemundo paying. It's the network that buys the novella in Spain. So I do know how that works since I began my career in Mexico. Yeah, of course, doing the show for TBS, being in contact with another actors that are protected by SAG-AFTRA made me realize that there has to be some changes. And that's what made me speak up. Most of the actors, Hispanic actors, they are afraid to speak because they are afraid that they may get punished by Telemundo or by whatever company, because Telemundo is the only company that is producing projects in Spanish right now in Miami, but there have been a lot of other companies that they didn't pay the royalties or whatever, like Venevisión, like Nickelodeon in Spanish. So there's a lot of companies. It's not just Telemundo.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that it's completely different if it's the same American-owned company doing something, as you said, in Spanish versus in English, that it makes such a big difference. Thanks so much, Pablo, and I hope it goes well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Coming up after a short break, director Jonas Cuarón and actor Gael García Bernal tell us how they set out to make Desierto, a film about crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, before there was any talk of building a wall. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The new Mexican film Desierto stars Gael García Bernal as Moises, who is part of a group of migrant workers struggling to cross the border into the United States. They are stalked by a sniper in a giant truck decked out with a faded Confederate flag, who is determined to kill every last one of them.
I have a son in the United States. I promised him I would get back to him.
Desierto was written and directed by Jonas Cuarón, son of the Academy Award-winning director Alfonso Cuarón. It is Mexico's foreign language submission to the Oscars this year. Cuarón and García Bernal sat down recently with KCRW's Madeline Brand. The director said when he set out to make this film, he had no idea that the reaction to it would be heavily influenced by this year's election.
Look, when I wrote the script, I really thought that by the time the movie would come out, that would be its main criticism, that it was far-fetched. But honestly, after this year where these elections have flooded this country with a speech and a rhetoric of hatred, I really more and more believe it's not so far-fetched.
So you did not set out to make a political film, or you did set out to make a political film? Because it's being marketed, when I look at the poster, as a horror film.
No, definitely the movie is a horror film, but my original intent as a filmmaker was to make a movie that spoke about the subject matter of migration and also this hatred we have towards anything that's different than ourselves. I thought in the process that the best way to tell this story was through genre, because this way I could reach a wider audience, I could not preach to the converted, as you say in English, and also engage the audience in a visceral way, you know, like engage them through emotions with a punch straight to the stomach instead of trying to engage through rhetoric and discourses and just the intellect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually yesterday somebody came up with a very good term to encompass these two like points of view of a political or action horror movie, which are not exclusive of each other. So basically it is a political horror movie because it is about the humanization of someone. And that is horrific. And that is political as well.
And Kaya, let's talk about the migrant character that you portray. And how did you prepare for that role, for understanding what it was like to cross the border and going through all that hardship?
Unlike any other film, I think in this case, when Jonas approached me to do this movie, I had already done a few short film documentaries and also a feature-length documentary on the issue of migration. And the investigation I did was a very close, heartfelt investigation as well. And that is basically what you do as an actor. You empathize with the emotional journey, no, of the characters, and you understand the context and you color it and you embody it. So when he called me to do this movie, I was already prepared, not only prepared to portray the character, but also to set up, let's say, fresher points of view on this issue.
Talk about, if you would, making this movie in the desert. Where did you shoot it, and what was it like shooting this movie in the heat?
We shot this movie in Baja California in Mexico, a couple hours north of La Paz. And honestly, the shoot was pretty complicated, and it had to do mostly with the remoteness of the locations. After 4 years of looking all over deserts everywhere, both in the US and Mexico, and even in Spain where Sergio Leone filmed his westerns, I found this amazing desert in Mexico that offered all the types of landscapes I was looking for. The problem is, you know, I had never made a movie, so I didn't know about logistics. And when I brought the whole team, they really hated me because it was a very remote place that had no infrastructure. And so in that sense, beyond the heat and the snakes and the just physical effort all the actors had to do every day on set, I do believe that the hardest part was just filming in such a remote place.
You mentioned Sergio Leone and the spaghetti westerns. And watching this, it did feel like a western. And it did feel like, I did feel for a minute that I was watching a Sergio Leone movie. How much did you look at those old Westerns, spaghetti Westerns, in terms of influencing how you looked at this movie or shot this movie, if you did?
No, definitely. It's a movie that, since the script, it was a movie about two characters confronting each other. So I knew that, like, all these Westerns were going to be very important references. So both, I really kept looking at them both for locations, but also once I started working with the cinematographer, with the DP, Damian Garcia, it was important to do the same thing Sergio Leone did, which was have that contrast between, like, really a camera that's really close on the characters with a camera that just has this, like, immense landscapes, you know? And so in a place like the desert has pretty ugly light. So, like, he really, in the few hours with decent light, Damien managed to give me all that, like, palette of different shots. Mm-hmm. That was important to create that dynamic feel that all those Westerns have.
Yeah. And then there's the showdown between the good and the bad, mm-hmm. right? And it also reminded me a little bit of Gravity, the movie that you wrote, your father directed, in terms of it focusing on one single individual against the elements.
Definitely. And, you know, what's curious is that I wrote the first draft of Desierto 8 years ago, and I showed it to my dad so that he would give me notes or criticism. And when my dad read the script, he became very interested in the concept, this idea of making a movie that was 90 minutes of straight action with almost no dialogues, but that through the action, you manage to talk about important themes. And so when he read the script, instead of giving me any notes, he said, I want to do something like this. And so he made me adapt it to space.
And that's where Gravity came up from. So you had written this before?
Yeah. A first draft.
So he really did steal it.
Yes.
Can say that now.
In retrospect, it's fine. The Oscars are there, no problem.
The WGA is not listening to this conversation, is it?
Might. So just say it.
So we touched on this a little bit at the beginning, but through the marketing of it as a horror film, as a Western, whatever, are you hoping to get in an audience that wouldn't necessarily go see a movie about migrants crossing the border?
This might be a very optimistic and earnest point of view from my side, but it is always the hope, you know, that these films that we do, and mainly the films we do in the Spanish language, you know, it's they're films that we kind of like find it very hard to fall into a category of what type of movie we're making. You know, I feel that we want to set them free. We want to just do a good movie, you know. And so we're hoping that definitely this film is a very action-packed movie, and it is an exercise in action in a very solid, very basic elemental concept that later brings in this whole political, social complexity as well. But at the same time, we just want to, like, see what the reaction is, you know, as well. Like, I'm very curious to see what it is now. We've been talking about this film for many, many years. This issue has been something that we've been touching each in our own different ways. But now it coincides with this moment in the United States where one presidential candidate is based his whole political career that he's having, or the whole campaign, on demonizing criminalizing Mexicans. Let's be frank, you know, that's what he said in the first time that he announced himself that he wanted to be president. So, you know, I think it is now up to the cinema goers that go and get surprised and see that if this film shakes up and also unveils a kind of issue in a very frontal way. This film depicts the nightmare that we might live if we continue developing and allowing and normalizing this hate speech. This is something that can happen. And it is around the corner, you know? And I hope that that gives an impact.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
That's Gael Garcia Bernal and Jonas Cuaron. We've been talking about their new movie. It's called Desierto.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
So Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.